Morning. Redeeming Lot's daughters. If you don't know who Lot's daughters are, you might be thinking, redeeming Lot's of daughters? What are we talking about today? Who is Lot and why should I care about the redemption of his daughters? Genesis chapter 19. If you're not familiar with the story, I think these two verses are probably more than all of us bargained for. Genesis 19:36. Thus, both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The first bore a son and called his name Moab. He's the father of the Moabites. The younger bore a son called Ben-Ammi, and he is the father of the Ammonites. What is going on in this family? This story is here, and these are God's people. I mean, do you read these stories ever? And this isn't the only time something like this shows up in Scripture, and you think, wait a minute, I thought the Bible was a handbook for life, right? I thought this was a model of how we're supposed to act, right? I mean, what if this story's in here, does God approve of this kind of a story? I don't know about you, a story I approve of is The Sound of Music. We have any Sound of Music fans in here? I was in some ways culturally famished growing up, but I only recently discovered The Sound of Music. And I don't know if this song is in all the renditions of it, but when the one of the main protagonists, Mr. Von Trapp, right, Captain Von Trapp, he's going to marry this woman, and it's not the woman he ends up marrying. And what decides it for him is this song where he figures out what is most important to this woman and how it doesn't quite match up with him. And the end of the song, she's singing, and the song, I'm not going to sing it, but so every star on every planet and every constellation in the sky revolves around the center of the universe, that lovely thing called I. And there's no way to stop it. No, there's no way to stop it. I know, though I can't tell you why. Just as long as I'm living, there'll be nothing else as wonderful as I. One way to ruin Valentine's or Thanksgiving, right? Or any of the holidays, for that matter. I think you know a family's healthy when they can laugh. So I'm thankful for that. It really takes a lot of the pressure off because you know I've fumbled over things plenty of times. So a way to ruin those holidays or any relationship, right, is when someone is more interested in themselves and in gratifying themselves right now. And Mr. Von Trapp loves this woman, but he's like, wait a minute. She might love herself more than she's able to love me or my children. So spoiler alert there. But I think that's part of why the story of Lot's daughters is in here, is it shows us the consequence of the me now lifestyle. Satisfy me, satisfy my desires now. And you end up in this crazy, tragic place. These make for difficult relationships. They make for different family relationships when the most important person is me and what I want right now. But we're going to look at Abraham because I look past his interaction with God, and it's such a contrast to the lifestyle of Lot's daughters. And what he does not only keeps him from the me now lifestyle, but I think in a pretty incredible way, it promises us all redemption. Some of us have stories in our past or family dynamics in our past. Maybe it's not Lot's daughters, but maybe it's something kind of crazy. And we all hope that there's hope that we can even overcome that. In music, you know, you have the chorus and you have the melody, but sometimes you have this time where it's a refrain. It's a bit of a bridge. It's the same story, but it's a little bit of a pause. Genesis 18, where we're going to spend our time, I want to look at this as though it's a worshipful refrain. There's the main story, and there's the main point of the story, but then there's this pause where God and Abraham have this interaction, where Abraham lingers with God. Abraham is remembered as the friend of God, and yet there's no question that God was Abraham's Lord. What does that look like? And how ultimately is God able to turn stories, seemingly tragic stories, upside down? Let's go to Genesis 18. The lordship and friendship that God shares with Abraham, it beckons Abraham to linger. Let's look at what I'm saying here. Verse 22 in chapter 18. So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham stood before the Lord. Then Abraham drew near and said, "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you, God, to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just?" God is going to do what? God is on his way to destroy this notoriously wicked city that abuses people, that does not honor God's gift of sexuality. God is on his way to do justice, and yet God pauses. Abraham has just been given this exciting news that, hey, even though you're old, and even though you've struggled with the promise some, that I'm going to give you a son, and your wife is going to become pregnant, and the promise is still going to come through you. God is being pulled to judgment and justice, and Abraham needs to go back home, and they both have important things to do, and yet there's this refrain where they pause and they linger. We do that with friends, right? I know I've got to be someplace, and it's important, and I got to get home, and I got to do this thing, and yet with friends, we're able to linger with them, aren't we? Don't you find yourself pausing? You create this space, and even if that space is filled with silence, it means something to the relationship. And so their friendship together finds this space, and Abraham wants to express something to God. He wants to know, God, how are you going to treat the righteous? I mean, if there's 50 righteous people in this awful city of Sodom and Gomorrah where my nephew Lot and his family lives, if there's 50 people there, why don't you spare that city for them to use? If you've read, turn over just a moment to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. There's some hard stuff in Ecclesiastes. I think Solomon tried to live the me now lifestyle, and he figures if that's what you live on earth, it's ultimately hopeless. And good things happen to bad people, and bad things happen to good people. And Abraham just is not at peace with this idea that God might do something bad to righteous people. I think if Abraham had read Ecclesiastes, he would have struggled with it. I mean, tell me if this sits well with you, Ecclesiastes 9. "But all this I had laid in heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. It's the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil." Is that a world you're interested in living in, where you're righteous and yet you get the consequence of what the wicked do? You know, we raise up our kids, hey, do the right thing, make the right choice, ultimately it'll be okay, except it won't be, and it's all hopeless anyway. I mean, is that the world that we want to live in, where righteousness is not treated? I think Abraham would have scratched his head with us that, man, Ecclesiastes is a hard book. He can't stand the thought of God treating the wicked people the same as the righteous people, of treating the righteous people the same as the wicked. And that's a part of true friendship, too. I mean, we've all had those friends who we go to and we're like, I did this thing that wasn't good. Can you just not tell my parents about that? You know, we've done that, right? We've had those friendships. But is that a true friendship? Are those friendships you look back on fondly and you're like, boy, they hid some awful things that I did that I'm proud of today? I mean, as you grow up to be an adult, the friends that you really hold on to are the ones who come to you and they say, boy, it pains me to say this to you, and I'm not sure what it's going to do to our relationship, but I'm not going to excuse this bad behavior. I care about you too much for you to do something foolish. And to think, this is Abraham. I got to get back to my family, and God, I know you're going to do important business, but I'm not going to let you go until I know what you're doing is the right thing, that you're being merciful to these people. A true friendship refuses to excuse or hide bad behavior. Look at these verses again. He's saying, God, far be it from you to put the righteous to death along with the wicked. Now, Abraham knows God, and he knows that God has moral sense enough to tell good from bad. That's not what he says. God, I'm really worried that you don't know the right thing to do here, that you don't know the difference between a good and bad person. Does Abraham have any, is he questioning? God, I'm not sure you're powerful enough. That city needs destruction. I'm not sure you're powerful. Is that Abraham's question here? No, he says, actually, he knows God's power so much, he says, I'm worried he's just going to wipe the place off the face of the earth. And he also knows that God has the ability to read our hearts. We can hide our hearts from each other, but Abraham knows God's going to go in there and he's going to know the heart of every single person. The question is, are you going to act justly, God? All this is to say that Abraham sees God as his friend, but also as his Lord, and so he has this silent space, this refrain that he invites God into. I mean, I know Abraham is not getting on his knees and praying to God, but it certainly seems like he's worshipful, and he's created this space in which to interact with God. Let's go on to verse 26. The Lord says, If I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake. Abraham answered and said, behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy a whole city for lack of 5? And God said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. Now it almost seems like Abraham is trying to talk God down. Okay, 50? Can I get 50? Okay, can I get 45? Can I get 40? It seems like he's trying to talk God down, like Abraham knows something that God doesn't. But, I mean, is that the God that we serve? I don't know. How many righteous people are in Sodom and Gomorrah? Is that the God that you want to give your soul to? You know, God is going through the ledger of our life, and he's like, I just can't remember some of the good things you did. I guess I'll ship you off, right? That's not the kind of God that we serve. Is God the one here who doesn't know? I have this feeling like God knows what he's going to do, but he also, to his friend, wants to bring Abraham in. And Abraham's like, you're not going to do it for 50. And God says, no, I'm not going to do it for 50. And they go all the way down to 10. But I want to notice what happens to Abraham. I think he kind of comes in here saying, I'm going to talk God down. But he quickly is humbled. What a concept, right? Being humbled in prayer. Well, you're not supposed to see that yet. So I grew up in a small hometown, 7,000 people, but we had lots of big fish in little ponds, which was nice for fishing. But athletically as well, and I see it better now, but we all thought we were stud muffins, right? in a town of 7,000, right? We thought we were hot stuff. I remember there was a coach, and I wish they would make a banner of this, but I remember one of our middle school basketball, are you kidding me, right? Like, we thought we were hot stuff in middle school. And I remember the coach saying, you know, we've got big kids, we've got talented kids. I would give anything for kids who are coachable. You know, but that doesn't work as a slogan. We want docile kids. We want, right? That docile is kind of a weird word, right? It seems like it's weakness, right? Oh, he's really docile. But when this word first came around, it comes from this word to teach. And docile actually doesn't mean weak or limp, but it means that you are apt and willing to learn. And you know, especially at those lower grades as a coach or as a teacher, right? Bible class teachers, wouldn't you just give anything? I don't care where the kids come from. If you have a good family or a bad family or whatever kind of family, if you come and you're willing to learn, isn't that worth anything? And so Abraham comes and he figures out God knows something that he doesn't. And what does he say here? After he says, okay, God, how about 50, you know? And he's like, wait a minute, this isn't working out the way I thought it would. He says, he stops and he says, whoa, I'm speaking to God. And what does he say? I'm smarter than God? What's he say there in verse 27? Behold, I who am but dust and ashes. Now, what does that make you think of, dust and ashes? Does that take you back to Abraham? Abraham, this is Abraham. Does that take you back to Adam? You know, man was formed from the dust, formed by who? By God. And it's like Abraham, you know, maybe he heard the stories about Adam, which he could have, right? You see Adam up there in the left-hand corner for you. He lived a long time. He could have told stories all the way down to somebody named Methuselah. And Methuselah, I mean, we're covering lots of time here, but the grandfathers actually overlapped quite a bit. And so by the time you get down here to Abraham, who could have talked to Noah, who could have talked to somebody who knew Adam. And so, you know, Grandpa Adam always referred to himself as old dust and ashes, right? But that's actually a very humble biblical concept, right? To remember, we are dust and ashes. And even when we go to God and we have maybe a legitimate concern, we need to be open to Him teaching us in that moment. Okay, you are God. I am dust. Maybe there's more going on here than I realized. There's a really confusing verse in Luke chapter 10, verse 12, and we won't go there, but Jesus actually brings up Sodom and Gomorrah, but he doesn't bring it up in the way that we would expect. He says, you remember Sodom? He doesn't go on to say they deserve to be burned and they're going to be in the worst circle of punishment. What he actually says is things are going to be more bearable for Sodom. Things will be more bearable for Sodom in judgment than people who refuse to listen to Jesus. Jesus is sending his workers out, and he says, you're going to go into a town, and you're going to start talking about me. And if people reject you, shake the dust off your feet, go on to the next city. Things will be more bearable on judgment for Sodom than they will for those who reject Jesus as their Lord. I'm not saying that Sodom and Gomorrah is not going to be punished. What Jesus is saying here is lordship, placing Jesus as the highest, saying, I'm going to learn from Jesus no matter how much it changes the way that I think. Verse 33, go back to Genesis 18, verse 33. They've kind of haggled, they've gone down, and Abraham's got to this place where he's like, okay, God, how about 10? And God says, I'm not even going to destroy this place for 10. And I don't know why Abraham doesn't keep going all the way down to 1. Maybe he's embarrassed, maybe he gets God's point. And then there's this powerful verse, and the Lord went his way. And God went his way. And inevitably, God is always going to go His way. And sometimes we see the way things are going and that it's going to go God's way. We're like, God, I'm not sure that's the best way. And we spend time with God in prayer, and we fill ourselves up with His Word, and we commune with people who are Christians. And the clearer we see that situation and we wrap our minds around who God is, we say, wow, God is way more merciful. Abraham would have been fine starting out with, you know, less than 50 people being killed. And he comes to find out, wait a minute, maybe God is not going to let a single righteous person out of this. He's not going to forget about a single righteous person. But praise be to God that He invites Abraham in to see that the Lord's way is always the most merciful way. So what assurance do we have of Abraham lingering with God? How about us? When we choose to linger with God and to learn, to create space, maybe that, I don't know when that space in your day or in your week is, but you create that space to linger with God, to take your concerns to Him, and to be willing to learn from Him. There's an assurance that we don't have to face the sin of this world alone. Abraham finds out just how corrupt Sodom and Gomorrah is, and God is right there with him. Does the world ever shock you at how corrupt it can be sometimes? Sometimes you have to shut the news off. You're like, man, that's enough for a week. The assurance is that God walks with us. He does not leave our side. You get to the end of Genesis 19 and you're really discontent with the story of Lot's daughters and how sad their story is, which is the way it should be. But we can't stop reading. We can't stop reading in Genesis 19. There's an assurance that if we keep reading, God places tragic stories within a larger victory. Genesis 19, verse 29. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered who? He remembered Lot? No. It says God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow. There was one righteous man in the city, and Abraham went to God on behalf of the city, saying, God, act justly toward these people. And what did God do? God went in and He rescued all the righteous people to be found there. So here's the grand climax. You know who Ruth's great-great-great-grandfather was, right? Ruth was a Moabitess. Right, the oldest daughter of Lot had a child by her father, and it spawned the Moabites. And Ruth is a Moabite woman. Imagine having Lot's story in your background. Ruth turns Moab's history inside out, becoming mother not to the enemies of Israel, but to the father of David. After Sodom comes a Moabitess who is incorporated into Israel so that Israel may be saved. If you need to see this visually, I hope this shows up. Here's Adam to Noah on the bottom and then back up to Abraham, and you get to David, but you don't get from Abraham to David without Boaz and Ruth. Boaz was a descendant of Abraham, but God chooses to take Ruth. Now, listen to some of the words spoken by Ruth, and tell me if this sounds more like a giver or a taker. Ruth chapter 1. Naomi, who is Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi says, look, Ruth, there's no hope with me. I'm not going to have any more sons. And even if I did, they're not going to grow old enough, quick enough for you to have a child. If you stay with me, there's no hope of you having a child. There's no hope of you having anything. Verse 14, my translation, this is David's translation, says Ruth waits. Actually, what it says is it says that Ruth clung to her mother-in-law. No hope. No hope of fulfilling her desire to be a mother, of a wife, of any kind of fulfillment. And somehow Ruth says, I'm not going to live for me, I'm going to live for this woman who has given much to me. And then what she says here, verse 15, The mother-in-law says, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return to your sister-in-law." But Ruth says, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. From where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried." Just put that on your Valentine's card next year, right? Boom, victory right there. It says, "I'm not going to live for me, and I'm not going to take what I think I should have. I'm going to live for you and be a part of your people." 1 Corinthians, and you can do this with your own name, but I think it really works with the name of Ruth. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4. I'm going to take love out. I'm going to put Ruth's name in there. Go back and read her story, and you see her living this life. Ruth was patient and kind. Ruth was not envy, nor did she boast. Ruth was not arrogant or rude. Ruth did not insist on her own way. Ruth was not irritable or resentful, though the Lord knows she had plenty of reason to be irritable and resentful. Ruth did not rejoice at wrongdoing, but she rejoiced in truth. She bore all things, she believed all things, she hoped all things, she endured all things, and Ruth's story does not end. And I envision, I don't know if this really happened, this is apocryphal writings of David, but I would write a story about the envisioned meeting in heaven between Ruth and Abraham. Can you envision that? I mean, Abraham sat down and he started praying for this wicked city, and he's like, "God, save the wicked people of this," or the wicked people, I'm sorry if I said that. "God, save the righteous people of this city." Never meeting Ruth, never knowing that this person was going to live and be recognized by God. And I imagine Ruth coming up to Abraham in heaven and saying, "Thank you for praying for your enemies. Thank you for always inviting God into your silent space. Thank you for telling us about how God humbled you in these moments. Thank you for living removed from evil. And thank you for never giving up on Lot in prayer. Thank you for looking back and learning from the mistakes of your fathers and choosing not to repeat them. Thank you for giving and for waiting for God. Grandfather Abraham, thank you for praying with an eye to the future, even an eye to the future that you did not see. And as you were a turning point in your family, I thank God that he helped me to be a turning point in my family as well." Don't you want to see that kind of a reunion? How about you as grandparents and as parents? The people that you pray for and how God works in people's lives, generations down, don't you want to have them come up to you? Don't we want to be a part of that kind of a reunion? People that we never see coming up and saying, "I know life was difficult, but thank you for being givers. Thank you for waiting." So let's not grow weary of doing good, of praying for each other. And if you have an Abraham story farther up in your life, if you have a story of a grandparent or a friend or a distant relative who was that turning point, embrace that story and share that, because we all need those stories in our lives. God bless us as we strive to be givers and we strive to wait for his fulfillment. Let's all stand and sing together.